NBC News Radio, I'm Tom Graham. Mitt Romney is taking a more centrist position as he campaigns for a second day in Florida. Meanwhile, fundraising in California, President Obama is working to extend his cash advantage over Governor Romney. But NBC Meet the Press moderator David Gregory says that gap may be closing.
I don't think campaign cash is going to be a huge issue for either side, but it is a measure of some enthusiasm, which right now is benefiting Republicans a bit more, and certainly Romney helped himself in that regard with such a strong debate.
More bad news at the pump for California drivers. Gas up 50 cents from just a week ago, now averaging 466.
It was a bit of a perfect storm of bad events, really. We had a low supply level of gasoline, and layered on top of that, it's got a couple of refinery problems and an oil pipeline problem.
And that's AAA California spokesperson Jeffrey Spring. In Florida, a private rocket launch from the company SpaceX is scheduled today. Weather, though, could scrap those plans. This is NBC News Radio. The outcome of a legal battle over public pensions in Rhode Island could lead to similar action in several states.
In recent years, as many as 43 states have taken some kind of action to address pension costs. All told, facing a $1.4 trillion gap between what they've promised workers and what they've set aside to meet those promises. And lawmakers are finding fixing the problem is not easy politically or legally. Last year, Rhode Island lawmakers suspended pension increases, raised retirement ages, and made other changes to save $4 billion over 20 years. Now, public sector unions say the state is betraying its workers and are suing to block the changes. Scott Carr, NBC News Radio.
France is boosting security at Jewish religious sites after blanks were fired at a synagogue west of Paris. This comes amid renewed concerns about anti-Semitism. The polls open in Venezuela today. President Hugo Chavez is facing his toughest election yet as he works to win yet another six-year term. I'm Tom Graham, NBC News Radio.
In the nation, trees fall, traffic lights fail, ceilings come down, and brakes lock up. And when the you-know-what hits the fan, Nationwide Insurance hits the ground running. Because you're not just our first priority, you're our only priority. We put members first because we don't have shareholders. Call 1-877-NATIONWIDE today.
Nationwide is on your side.
Nationwide Mutual Insurance Company and Affiliates, Columbus, Ohio, subject to underwriting guidelines, review, and approval.
In 2011, the Weather Channel launched Coast Guard Alaska. In 2012, things are heating up. As we head south, the Weather Channel presents Coast Guard Florida, a new series that follows the brave men and women who patrol the turbulent waters of the Sunshine State.
Coast Guard, a request assistance.
Weathering stormy and steamy conditions.
I want to get out there. I want to get out there fast.
Putting their lives on the line is all in a day's work. Coast Guard Florida premieres Wednesday, October 10th at 9 on the Weather Channel.
I'm Beyonce with an important message about hunger in America. Did you know 1 in 8 people struggle with hunger? Over 12 million children live in homes where there isn't always enough food. Food banks are experiencing more demand than ever. Show Your Helping Hand is a nationwide campaign with the goal of helping Feeding America deliver millions of meals to local food banks. Please join me in showing a helping hand to fight hunger. More information is available at showyourhelpinghand.com.
Congratulations on landing the job. I'm really excited for you.
Thanks. How's your search going?
Job market's tight. I mean, I can barely get an interview.
Yeah.
And I've got student loans to deal with. You're lucky, you know. The National Guard paid your loans off.
Luck? The Guard was a smart decision, one you can still make.
The National Guard Student Loan Repayment Program can pay up to $50,000 of your existing student loans. Get the details at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the D.C. National Guard, aired by the Maryland, D.C. Delaware Broadcasters Association and this station.
Hey, everybody. It's David and Nikki Nellis from the wildly popular and always topical Foodie and the Beast.
And on Sunday, October 7th, we're talking delis. Did you know a new deli is coming to D.C.? We're going to hear from Chef Barry Koslov and Nick Wiseman and Catoctin Creek. They've got new products, and they'll be pouring it in studio.
A new deli? Are we talking India? That's Foodie and the Beast next Sunday and every Sunday live at 11 on 1500 AM.
I'm on a mission to spread the word about COPD through music. COPD stands for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. My grandfather suffered from symptoms of it, and COPD is the fourth leading cause of death in the U.S. I'm Billy Ray Cyrus, and I drive for COPD. Looks like people are starting to get the message. Anyone age 35 and older who has smoked as little as 100 cigarettes could be at risk. Visit driveforcopd.com today and talk to your doctor.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired and entertained and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, and I'm joined by my co-host, David Taylor, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. We have a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Sid Fuchs, who's the president and CEO of Macaulay Brown and the author of Get Off the Bench, Chris Lessard, the president of Lessard Design, Alan Cullen, the president of Todd Allen, and Tom Anderson, president of the Science, Technology, and Engineering Group for Wiley. First up is Sid Fuchs. He's the president and CEO of Macaulay Brown and also the author of Get Off the Bench. What is Macaulay Brown, Sid?
Thanks, Peter. Great to be here. Macaulay Brown is an engineering company that serves the defense and intelligence communities. Founded in 1979, based in Dayton, Ohio, with approximately 2,000 employees. We do mostly engineering type work, cybersecurity, R&D, systems engineering, software development.
And when did you become the CEO?
I joined the company in August of 2011.
In 2011, so not a long time. Why did you want to run this place?
I felt like, well, first of all, Macaulay Brown is a privately held company, which gives us a very long-term view of the business and the ability to really manage the business in a way you can't in the public or private equity-backed company. So when I met with the owners and I clicked immediately. They had the same objectives that I did, was to grow a company to $1 billion. And they had a very long-term view of the business where they didn't want to do it overnight. They wanted to take their time, do it methodically, do it the right way. And that was very attractive to me.
Say a little bit more about that. What about that made that attractive to you?
I love the challenge of growth, trying to grow companies. And I've done that with every situation I've been in as a CEO or as an executive. I like big goals. I like very challenging goals. And going from 350 to $1 billion is a big goal, especially in this environment.
Right.
And the owner was as passionate about it as I am, so I felt like it was a good alignment.
So this isn't your first bite of the apple. Tell us about some of your background.
I was the president of TASC, which is a subsidiary of Northrop Grumman, back in 2002. And I became president when the group was about $400 million, about the same size. And we grew to $1.2 billion in 4 years organically with no acquisition. That was a great run. We took a lot of risks. We tried a lot of different techniques, and I think we were pretty innovative when we got there. And I want to do it again. And I think this is a great place to do it.
So where did this need to grow something small to big start in you?
I think it's the need to be extremely competitive and hate to lose.
Where did that start showing up?
I think it's sports at a young age. I also had an older brother, 7 years older than me, that would, other than beat me up on a regular basis, I was always trying to compete with him because he was a good athlete and a good musician and good at most things he did. So I was always trying to be like my big brother.
Uh-huh. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in New Orleans.
And what was life like in New Orleans?
It was almost like a Mark Twain existence. I lived about a block from the Mississippi River. Rode my bike everywhere, across the ferry into the French Quarter. Very, in the 60s in New Orleans, a very fun time, a lot of Mardi Gras and Saints games and a lot of cookouts. Just a very, very, very nice environment to grow up in as a kid.
Yeah, what were Mom and Dad doing when you were growing up?
Dad was an auto mechanic. Mom was a housewife. I can always remember weekends having friends. They were having friends over, having beers and crawfish and listening to music on the stereo. It was a very party-like atmosphere. It was very good.
How about significant influences or shaping events? What was happening early in the childhood that, looking back on it, really shaped you?
My dad was a pretty hard taskmaster. He really instilled a very dominant work ethic in all the kids. And my dad was an incredibly smart man. For never having graduated from high school, he grew up during the Depression. But he taught me to be the expert in things that I approached and to know more about a subject or work harder on a subject than anybody else.
What did you major in college?
I eventually majored in mechanical engineering.
But you didn't start with that.
No, actually, my first degree or a chance at a degree was a music scholarship to Loyola. to study jazz guitar. And after deciding I didn't want to be a starved musician in New Orleans, I thought I'd be a journalist because I like to write. Then I realized that that might not be the best career field either. Now, when I was a freshman in college, my dad got cancer. And it was a very traumatic situation for the whole family. As an auto mechanic, he didn't have, you know, things to fall back on. We were basically living paycheck to paycheck. So I realized I needed to have a job or career where I had steady income and some sort of job security. And so I decided to study engineering, even though I was terrible at math and hated math and was more of a, you know, music writer type, right? So I went with engineering anyway.
How do you suppose your father's illness impacted you?
It made me realize that you've got to prepare for the unknown. I don't think my dad thought that way. It was sort of paycheck to paycheck. The exposure wasn't anything more than what's happening in the next weekend. You know, when's the next fishing trip coming up? When's the next Saints game? And I'm a planner. You know, I like to project years out. I like to say, what's the worst case scenario if something happens? So I try to provide contingencies for things that could happen.
So you got a degree in engineering. What'd you do after college?
I was recruited by the CIA in my graduate program, joined the agency, spent 8 years as an officer, and then I went in the private industry.
What were the years in the CIA like for you?
They were incredible. President Reagan was in office. William Casey, if you remember him, was there. It was a very special time. We did some very great things. I was involved with some very big projects of national importance at a very young age. I was very lucky. I just helped in, you know, timing and placement got me in there. But very proud of my days with the agency. I remain close friends with my agency colleagues and bosses from back then.
Why not stay in and make a career of it?
I was working in the field and loved the job and was getting promoted. I was a 32-year-old GS-14, and so my reward for doing well was become a manager. And I was 32 and wasn't ready to be in an office, but they wanted me to go into management. And I decided, well, if I'm going to go into management and be in an office, I might as well go into industry and, you know, make some money and do something different.
Uh-huh.
And I always stayed in the intelligence field because I left to go to work at Digital Equipment Corporation as a sales manager, but working back in the intelligence community.
So talk about your trajectory. Why did you want to advance your career and become a leader of companies at some point?
I saw my dad, who was incredibly smart, as I said, but didn't have the formal education because he couldn't. I saw him not get where he wanted to be because of the limits he had. And I didn't want to be limited. I wanted to go as far as I could, as fast as I could, and see what I was capable of. It was more of a personal challenge to see what I was capable of versus titles or money or position. I just wanted to keep reinventing myself and go as far as I could.
Mm-hmm.
You had mentioned to us in the green room that you get back to New Orleans frequently. Could you tell us just a little bit about the impact of Katrina and what impact it had on you and your family?
Sure. Obviously, Katrina was devastating for a lot of people. My family, my parents are deceased, but my brothers and sisters still live there. They all had to evacuate. They were gone for months. I had an aunt that lost a house. There's nothing left but the foundation. And it impacted everybody in a major way. My sister, one of my sisters, we couldn't find her for a few weeks because telephone lines were out, cell phones were down, and we couldn't communicate with her. We finally got in touch with her, but we were worried, obviously. But I think the city has recovered pretty well. I think that period was very troublesome for everybody. I had a lot of sleepless nights and wondering what was going on. Couldn't get down there, obviously, because it was all blocked off. But it was a real American tragedy.
So, I mean, what was it like? So if you were living a mile away from the Mississippi, I'll bet your hometown where you grew up was underwater.
Not all. It really depends where you were along the river. Now, my college roommate that I went to LSU with, his house had water up to the roof. Totally destroyed his house. Now, the house I grew up in, which we had sold years ago, didn't have any water.
Mm.
So the city is like a rolling valley and hills. Some are low spots, some are high spots. So if you're lucky enough to be in the high spots, no water. But if you're in a lakefront or certain parts of the quarter, you are underwater.
Yeah. Where did you learn how to lead?
I think in an early age playing sports. I've always been a student of leadership. I like to watch people in leadership roles, and I like to learn from their styles and personalities. I've had several people tell me they noticed that I pick up traits from other people, the good traits that I want. And I think I learned as a young child from my dad. My dad was, I think, a natural leader as well. He was a person people would rally around He was known as an expert on what he was doing. And I think that, you know, the sports obviously helped a lot as well.
Great.
You had mentioned earlier that you did write a book called Get Off the Bench.
I did.
What is the book about, and what led you to write a book?
I have been writing articles and material for about 10 years on leadership, project management, networking, different various topics. And I've always wanted to write a book. I felt like I had a lot of material. As you can tell, I'm always somebody who has an opinion and had a perspective and happy to share it. But several people have told me I should write a book, a lot of public speaking. So I decided to write about something I was passionate about, and that's people and networking. I didn't want to write another leadership book because we have enough of those already, and I didn't think I could offer anything different. But I think networking is something I'm very good at. It's something I think is incredibly important. People are important, and it was something I could talk about with some level of authority.
So give us an example of what somebody who would read the book would find out about networking. People in networking.
I think the number one thing, or actually there's two, I'll give you two tidbits. One is networking is about giving to the other person. It's not about just taking. Now, all too often in a networking situation, we're shoving business card in somebody's face and trying to get something. My perspective is, I want to get to know you. How can I help you? And then maybe if there's something that you can help me with, that's great. So how do you build a relationship? The second sort of viewpoint is that when it's time to need a relationship, it's too late to build it. So you have to be proactive at identifying relationships in business or in personal life where you think you may need them later.
If I was interviewing your father, would he be surprised at your success?
No.
What would he say about you?
He'd probably say, why did it take me so long?
Uh-huh.
No, I think he would be a little surprised. I think he always knew that I was a high achiever and ambitious, but I think it's the body of work that I've been able to do over the last 25 years, and including my proudest thing is the family. I've married with three boys, two in college, one in high school, one at UVA, one at Virginia Tech, all straight A students, you know, all to boys like their dad was, very respectful, great family, married my college sweetheart, been together almost 30 years. I think he'd be most proud of that because I know I am.
Great. And if he was here, what would you want to tell him?
I miss him.
Oh. What's the website address, Sid?
It's www.sidfuchs.com.
Great. We've been speaking with Sid Fuchs, who's the president and CEO of Macaulay Brown and the author of Get Off the Bench. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Taylor, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney for helping with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment, right after this business spotlight.
Hi, this is Paul Smith from the Potomac Companies bringing you your business spotlight. Joining us today is
Jeff Poro.
And Jeff, who are you with?
I'm the head of Poro Associates, LLC.
And what is Poro Associates, LLC?
Well, I write speeches for corporate and nonprofit executives.
Oh, so you're a speechwriter?
Yes, I am.
Particular industries that you focus on?
No, I don't. I like to have a broad range of clients. It keeps me interested.
Do you also tend to write or just speeches?
I do other kinds of writing, but speeches are really my sweet spot.
Any particular topic?
I like them all. Recently, I've been doing a lot about corporate social responsibility and the environment, but that's just kind of who I'm working for now.
Is that more of a passion and focus of yours, or again, just who the clients you work with?
I would say it's more the clients. My passion really is to have a lot of different pieces of subject matter, and that's when I'm really happiest.
How did you get into this?
That's a good question. The short answer is I had been a general writer and kind of got a little bored with it and really thought about what kinds of writing really turns me on. And I realized that I'm most excited when I'm writing speeches.
So how do people find you? How do they know how to get in touch with you if they need help writing a speech for a performance or
presentation? Yeah, that's a very good question. The easiest way is I'm on the web, www.porollc.com. You can also find my columns in the Washington Business Journal. I write every month or two.
Oh, great. Do they put your picture in there too?
They do. And it's pretty flattering.
Well, we'll have to look for your picture. Again, this is Paul Smith bringing you your business spotlight. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. I'm joined by my co-host, David Taylor, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. This is Peter Schwartz, your host, and I'm happy to introduce Chris Lessard, who's the president of Lessard Design. What is Lessard Design, Chris?
It's an architectural firm that has projects all around the country. We work predominantly up and down the East Coast, and Also, we have companies in India, and we do projects in the Middle East. We're also actively doing projects in China, and we're looking at one in Vietnam.
Wow. When was the company founded?
In various forms, started in 86.
And how big or small today?
We're at 90 currently.
Uh-huh. Why start an architectural firm? Why do this?
Because I had no other choice. I had no other knowledge, like most other people.
It's no small task, starting a company, so come on.
Well, started in high school, in architectural drafting class. I got I think first in state on a project that reminds me of the Brady Bunch house, and ever since then, I kept going. My father was also a builder, and so I was always in the construction side of things.
And so you start the company in 1986. What was it like to start a business?
That's the easy part. The part is easy starting. You know, managing becomes different.
Uh-huh.
You know, we've grown at one point right before the downturn, we were 160 people, and then you're really managing things versus doing things.
So if you started in 1986, you've been through a couple of up and down economic cycles.
Yes. The 90s one was great, worked well for us because you just needed to rearrange the value of things. I think this current one, which the money's out of the system, there's not a whole lot you can do other than look for markets where there still is money.
Right. Why expand outside the country?
That's where the money is at places. Some markets are tougher than others. We found India as being extremely tough. We did a lot of design-only work. When we tried to do full service, it became a problem. Middle East, they're willing to afford the full service, which works out well. I think we also have started an international firm out of China, which the construction drawing side gets done from a Chinese firm. We're finding that working very well, and we're competing very well in China.
You're much more than an architect, though, you personally. How would you describe yourself?
I'm an entrepreneur. I also a managing member of Metropolitan Development, which owns apartments. I've also do land and land zoning and entitlements. We do projects all around the country, going from New England to Dallas. What challenges me, I get to learn new markets and bring what I know, but also learn what the markets are trying to tell me.
Where did the entrepreneurial thing come from?
Don't have a choice. One of eight. You got to compete for food.
So you were in the middle. I think you were telling us,
yes,
in the green room.
Yes, I was, so I can hide.
Chris, how has the Internet affected your business and your ability to do things in these far-off places?
Well, one thing, it means the people who work for me are far smarter than I am. They know technology far more than me. I think the Internet with Google, you're able to check on sites and never leave your office. So, you know, the fact that you're in a different location really doesn't affect you that much. You're able to research easily from Internet, and it allows you to communicate. You know, in the world of Skype, it costs nothing to have conference call meetings around the world, and I think you see that. I think other places in the world are probably more up to speed than even we are, because they're used to their economy having to go outside to do things. You know, we've been lucky in the United States; it's been healthy for so long, we didn't always have a need to go outside the areas.
Well, yeah. What has going outside of the confines of the United States taught you as a business owner? What's the big gift to you?
For me, it keeps my mind entertained. It also gets me to look at different things. You know, the assumption is that you can always take American ideas, to somewhere else, but reality is that you're getting the ideas from someplace too, and you can transport it. You know, we did a project in the Middle East where we had to deal with the cultural differences of the sexes. And through that, I've come up with an idea to do individual elevator course for office buildings in the United States, because that division of sexes have to happen there. Here, you're able to do it in a condominium fashion. So I thought that was interesting. You know, we've done projects in China where we're doing incubator offices for people that invent things, a concept that's not known in the United States. And we've hooked it up with exhibition halls, and they have a way of marketing, so you understand, and you can utilize your knowledge from the United States of marketing and leverage their ideas of trying something different. And their ideas have never been done before, which I find interesting.
Yeah, you were mentioning to us in the green room how the very way we use space is changing in the way that buildings are being designed. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, population demographics and how people live totally changed. You know, you'll see in like the Washington marketplace, units are getting smaller. Everybody socializes, so no one needs a dining room. Everything's related to computers now, so you know how that relates to spaces are important. So you have smaller spaces, but the focus on the computer technology is far greater now than any design we've ever done. So it's not just building a space, it's understanding how it's utilized.
So do you, as an architect and an entrepreneur, are you leading the change, or what? How do you stay fresh and how do you stay successful in this business?
We look at early trends. I don't know if I lead anything. I notice a trend early where a small population starts to do something, and then you leverage and take advantage of that. It's like a guy in Tampa, Harry Dent, does demographic studies. And his demographic studies, as he says, every technology that changes, you start to look and watch the geeks and see what they do first. They're willing to pay more for things than the average. And as soon as mass production starts, prices drop, and then they take over the marketplace. I mean, you can see that in phonographs and the records and all technology. Even when the original TVs came out, the plasma, I knew all I have to wait is 3 years and the price will just plummet when mass production takes
right.
effect.
So for you, it's about not being wedded to any particular approach or an idea? Is that what the secret to success is?
Yeah, I think in the construction industry, in the architecture industry, it goes through cycle changes more so than maybe other industries. Therefore, you must assume you're going to go through change even if things are good. So you're always preparing for the next cycle. And you either do that by expanding geographically or expanding your knowledge base of something you can serve. And so you're constantly looking for different things of expertise that you can take your business into.
Where did you learn to be this adaptable?
Probably, like I said,
being the middle.
being one of eight where you're forced to.
Chris, one of your passions now is coaching youth football. Tell us a little bit about that. How did you get into that and why?
I love it. Well, I mean, part of it is being with my son, but part of it is really helping develop kids for success and also building team. And in some degree, it's not just going out there and doing a sport. We make sure that we play flag football. We do things to bring the kids together so when it's crunch time, when you have to count on someone, you can count on the person next to you. I've lost one game in 2.5 years. And it's the kids, I get the most out of them, and they feel that they're part of something bigger than themselves.
What were you like as a kid?
Like any other kid, you know, trying to survive in one of eight, but, you know, outgoing, and like sports, you know, and back in those days, things weren't organized. Especially with one of eight, you just go outdoors and you can find any team you want. They're inside the house. So that made me active. And I think that helped me learn about team environment because you're always trying to survive in that environment.
How about important influences or things that shaped you early on, looking all the way back?
You know, in the green room, it's consistent. It's always a father or a dad. I mean, in my case, it's my father that kind of shaped me. He was a home builder, and he taught me that decisions and making speedy decisions are important. I think the biggest gift in today's world is really the ability to have speed, and technology is one of those items. You know, people are scared of making decisions, and the fact is you got to make them in today's world because the cost of time is probably the most valuable thing you have.
Yeah. Is there a decision you wish you could take back?
Probably a couple, but I'm not going to tell you.
Okay. How about your proudest moment?
I think it's every one of my children's birth. I mean, that's the only miracle I think most people will ever have. And the thing is each one special. You know, just because they're first doesn't make one more special than the next miracle you get a chance to see.
What's left for you to do in the space that you're in? What else would you like to accomplish?
Frankly, I think I'm probably going to move to another phase. You know, the thing is trying to always be better means that you can't stay where you are. And whether that's an architect or changing careers, you know, I will eventually retire from the architectural career, but that doesn't define me as retired. It defines me as taking on new tasks, you know, probably playing in land development type things more. And maybe spending more time in youth programs where I've, you know, over You know, I run a business, and the most satisfaction I've had in 10 years probably has been youth football.
Mm-hmm. If your father was sitting here, what would you want to tell him?
Thank you.
And your mom? What was her influence on you growing up?
Well, she's still alive at 86, 87. She was tough. She really was. You know, people say a housewife. No, she managed an army, and she was tough. She had a lot of stuff to do. She had to take care of a lot of the household. She did all the decisions in the household, more so than my father, because in those days, the father worked and mom basically controlled
the
father.
House.
So,
what do you think you learned from her?
She's probably a lot more effervescent than I. I'm not really that talkative. I'm forced to in business because I've chosen to eat. I think last time I was with you, I talked about stuttering. I'm really not public oriented. My mom just loves people, and I watch her, and she's fed by people around her. I'm not necessarily fed by that.
Great. What's the website address, Chris?
LasardeDesign.com.
Okay. Thank you.
You're making me think twice, huh?
We've been speaking with Chris Lessard, who's the president of Lessard Design. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Taylor, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. This is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is
Gordon Bernhardt.
Gordon, what is Bernhardt Wealth Management?
Bernhardt Wealth Management is a registered investment advisory firm. We're one of the top independent wealth management firms in the Washington, D.C. area.
What makes your company special?
I'd say three things. One is that we are a personal chief financial officer. We act in that capacity for our clients, so that means we help them address their investment issues. We also focus on the holistic approach, so that means we focus on wealth enhancement, wealth transfer, wealth protection, and charitable planning issues for our clients. Second area is that makes us special is that we are a registered investment advisor. We don't have a broker's license, and that simply means that we have a fiduciary duty to always act in our client's best interest. Most of the industry have broker's licenses, and some of them have advisory licenses, and a broker is held to a suitability standard. We're held to the fiduciary standard.
So what that means to a customer would mean that you work in their interest, not for the interest of the stock that you're trying to sell.
That is correct. And the third area that makes us special is that we have a very academic approach to investing. Everything that we recommend to our clients is strictly based on academic research.
And what do you enjoy most about this work?
I love helping clients. I'm passionate. I get satisfaction out of knowing that we touch people's lives. We can then, our role is basically free up their time so they can focus on what's important to them. For some of our clients, that means their family and grandkids. For some, it's their business. And others, it's their charitable interests. We solidify their relationships in those areas.
Great. How can someone reach you?
We can be reached by phone at 703-356-4380. Or on the web at bernhardtwealth.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and we've been speaking with Gordon Bernhardt from Bernhardt Wealth Management, and this has been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. I'm joined by David Taylor, my co-host with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. And for this segment, we have Alan Cullen, who's the president of Todd Allen. What is Todd Allen, Alan?
We are a commercial printer, commercial sheet-fed printer. We have six color presses and digital presses. Our job is basically, or our client base is basically, to deal with communication. We send information out for our clients to their members and clients.
How long has the company been around?
Started in 1974.
And how big or small are you today?
We used to be 127 people. We're down to 55 due to the economy.
Right. Why start a business?
Didn't really want to start a business per se. I just didn't like anybody else telling me what to do. So I figured that was the easiest way to get around it.
That's back in 1974, so you're a young guy.
Thank you.
Well, what was going on back then that, starting a business was the right way to go for you?
Well, I grew up in the printing industry. My dad was... He had a printing company started back in 1939. It grew, and he actually became one of the regional printers for TV Guide. He branched out to that. And I went to Carnegie Tech School of Printing Management. So it's really what everything I knew. Mm-hmm. When I got out of college, a public company had bought his printing company up, so I went to work for them in the publishing division. And after a while, that just didn't pan out. So I went out and did a number of freelance things and finally decided I had to have a steady paycheck, and I went back to what I knew best.
Which was printing. So how did you come to have the business, though? You were telling us an interesting story about that.
In terms of?
Buying it from the bank?
Oh, there was a, I got involved. My dad knew a one of the executives down at American Security and Trust, and they had gotten stuck on a check kiting scheme with a printing company. They were bouncing stuff back and forth between D.C. and Georgia, and it finally blew up in their faces, and they were stuck with a printing company, and they needed somebody to take it over, something, some vehicle to get it off their books. So they called my dad, and they brought me in, and made me a sweetheart deal, and I was back in the printing business.
So at a very young age, you were taking over a failing company.
Yeah, it was failed. It wasn't failing. At that point, it was pretty well failed.
So how did you do it?
I knew a couple of people that were in the industry and got one of them to come to work for us as a salesman. And then I put in more hours than my wife wanted to hear about. So I got there early in the morning and worked and took the work home at night and did the billing and came back in the daytime and went out selling during the day. And we just grew the company.
You make it sound so easy. What was the most difficult part for you?
The difficult part was the time away from the family. It's not something that you really want to do. But then again, it's a choice between what you have to do to make a living and staying home.
Yeah. At what point did you realize, man, I can make this thing happen?
When we started to be able to pay our bills a lot easier, and when people started recognizing the name, and you could make a cold call on a client, and they say, oh, I know Todd Allen. You did some work for this other person, and it was the old time where we could go out and you knew the business. So I had the background, so I could sit across the desk from a client and take a look at what used to be artboards, now it's a disc, and look at the job and pick up the phone, call a paper house and get a paper price and quote it right there. So the more I started walking away with jobs out of someone's office, then I knew it was starting to come in the right track.
Fast forward to today, Alan. Digital printing has come in. The Internet has come in. We all hear that print media are on the way down, or some people even say on the way out. What is the future of printing?
Future of printing, printing will always be here. It's not going to disappear. I mean, paper, people still love something on paper, and it has a historical value, but it's going to decline. The number of printers will be less. We lost about half of the printers in the last 5 years. Equipment has changed radically in the last 5 years. So when I traded up the last press, I got rid of a five-color press that was running about 7,000 sheets an hour and took 2.5 hours to set up, what we call make-ready. And I put a six-color press in that takes 20 minutes to set up and delivers 12,000 sheets an hour. So at that point, the old press, you could set up three jobs a shift, and this one you could set up three jobs in an hour. So when that technology came in, it made a lot of the old stuff obsolete, which it never did before.
So what is it about you that was able to anticipate the change, adapt to the change, embrace the change? What? I mean, why are you in the remaining 50%? Why you?
It's a very light blue-collar industry, and you still get a lot of contact with people. I like keeping 50 families supported. I would hate to see them go
well,
out.
I mean, with all due respect to the people that didn't make it, I'm sure they like keeping their employees.
We would have loved, yeah. It's still interesting. I like the challenge. Basically, when I grew up, and I still do, I'm a beginning, middle, and end kind of person. So I don't like things to go on in perpetuity anyhow. So I would not have chosen to have this kind of a radical shift, but it's not against my makeup to be able to handle it.
Is there something about, looking back on it, is there something about a willingness to let go of a certain way of thinking that's important about succeeding here?
Oh, you very definitely have to do that. We used to rely totally on historical data. I could tell you going into a month whether it's going to be a good month or a bad month, and all of a sudden 2 years ago, one of our best months fell flat. And so if you don't, I mean, if you don't respond to that and react to that, then you're going to be one of the 50% that's not there.
So when did you learn to get comfortable with uncertainty?
Probably my freshman year of college when I went to Carnegie Tech. Halfway through the first semester, they came in and said, "We're closing your school." And it was because they wanted to get rid of the industry schools to become a university. And that was a pretty scary thing, except then they gave us a little bonus and said you could do anything you wanted on the campus as long as you passed a minimum set of requirements. But that really knocked the pins out from me in terms of what was incredibly stable. Washington, D.C., where I was born and grew up, printing was always a very solid industry. I mean, you had to be a real idiot not to be able to support your family. And then all of a sudden, this is gone.
But then you did something radical in itself. You went to Berkeley for a while. Can you tell us about that? And then what you did after that?
Sure. Well, Berkeley was, I wanted to go out to California. And I applied to graduate school and for an MBA program, which was a two-year program because it was keyed for engineers. And obviously, if you're from Carnegie Tech, you're perceived to be an engineer. At that point, after the first year, I found out that I had done all the requirements, and I was even working on an analog computer project with a fellow that was pioneering business models on the analog, so I had a dissertation. So I just asked them, "Wow, how about if I take my comprehensives and, you know, I get my degree?" And they said, "No, you can't do it that way. We'll give you a leave of absence." So at that point, I found a travel group and a Dutch tourist group, and I went to Europe on a student ship back and forth for three or four summers, and I hitchhiked around Europe for a year. And that was a huge eye-opener in terms of how the world works, and it's different than what's in the textbooks, and diversity from a completely different perspective than I grew up in, being in the Washington, D.C. and the Pittsburgh area.
So how do you think that shaped the way you lead a company today, that experience all the way back then?
Well, I think it's given me a much more relaxed atmosphere in terms of dealing with people of different backgrounds and different cultures. It makes it easier because, I mean, if I had my choice, and I don't mean to sound silly, I would love to have one salesperson of every ethnic group, one salesperson of every race. That would be the perfect way to build an operation. And so I'm not opposed. We never have been. Diversity has never been an issue for the company.
Right. What's the toughest thing you've ever accomplished?
Probably keeping the company alive in the last three or four years when the economy went to pot. I think that's been the hardest structure because we came down from 127 people, and that's a lot of overhead to absorb. We're actually in a building that's twice as big as we need right now, so we have to negotiate that out. So we're carrying a lot of costs that we don't have to carry, and I think the fact that we're still here is somewhat of a miracle in itself.
Yeah. What's it like to have to take a company down to about half the size it once was?
It's painful because you're losing a lot of people that it's not their fault.
Right.
I mean, if you lose somebody that's not doing the job, you know, you can justify it. They just aren't qualified to do the job. But when they're doing the job, but our sales volume drops from like 16 million to 9, then you just can't keep everybody around. And unfortunately, and it's a bad business thing, we've been, you know, quick to hire, slow to fire. So we've kept people on historically in the hopes that, wow, March is coming up. March is going to be strong. April's going to come up, you know, and it just never did.
Yeah, it's been a brutal 4 years, I know.
It has not been fun.
Yeah. Why stay in the game?
I enjoy it. I mean, it's helped me do a couple of other projects that I really have fallen in love with, and it's made it, you know, it's given me the impetus to do that and the support to do that.
Looking back, what's the one thing you think you learned from your father that you couldn't have learned anywhere else?
Probably his work ethic. And a real clear understanding that don't take advantage of people. You know, even if somebody really needs it, don't, you know, you can charge them for the overtime that you have to put in, but don't clobber them for a job. And just be fair. Just be fair with folks.
How about your proudest moment up till now?
Business?
Either one, business or professional.
Well, I've been married. I've been married for 43 years. I got two great kids. They had great weddings. They're still all married. I got five grandchildren. That'd be tough. I'd get in big trouble if I had to pick one of those out. I'm not going to do that.
Okay, fair enough. What's the website address, Alan?
www.toddallen.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Alan Cullen, who's the president of Todd Allen. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Taylor, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney for helping me with the interview. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight. Good afternoon. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is
John Adams.
And John, what company are you with?
Pingtone Communications.
What is Pingtone Communications?
We are a service provider providing a hosted voice over IP service to business customers.
And what makes your business special?
Well, we provide a highly reliable and quality service to business customers where, you know, what we're doing today is unparalleled to a lot of the other service providers that have not been in our space as long. We've been doing this since 1999, catering to the metro DC market.
Is there a particular success story you like to reference in these situations?
We do a lot of work overseas with the troops that need to communicate back home to their families, morale, welfare, recreation. That's a small part of our business, but it's a part that's important to us. That's communication actually over satellite. So it's been pretty rewarding, that aspect of our business.
Great. What do you enjoy most about the job?
I enjoy bringing solutions to customers that have an impact on some of the things that they're trying to accomplish in their business, and, you know, seeing those ideas and the things that we provide allow them or enable them to realize those benefits.
Wonderful. And how can someone reach you?
www.pingtone.com.
Wonderful. This has been John Adams with Pingtone Communications, and this is Peter Schwartz with Vistage. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, and we're broadcasting today from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. I'm joined by my co-host, David Taylor, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. For this segment, we have Tom Anderson, the president of the Science, Technology, and Engineering Group for Wiley. What is all of that, Tom?
I'm glad to tell you, and thank you very much for having me here today. Wiley is, first of all, a company that's been in business for about 60 years. Has a presence in a variety of disciplines, including aerospace, the sciences, technology, and engineering, and has a presence in 24 states across the country. We're about 6,000 people, and most of our work is associated with public sector.
Mm-hmm. When did you join the company?
I joined the company about 2 years ago. I was asked to come in and help to turn around an organization that was was part of an acquisition that occurred of a small business, and now moving into the large business space, it needed, you know, I think, some focus with respect to the competition that's associated with the full and open market.
Right.
And about 2 years later, what we did is we brought together some of the capabilities of the organization, of the company, in the areas of the sciences and also engineering, and put that mm-hmm. together as this new group.
Yeah. Why do you suppose you were the ideal pick to do this?
I think that for a variety of reasons, but one is that, you know, it's a relationship-based business, and so I think that over time you have an opportunity to get to know a lot of people. I believe that there are the background, obviously, that plays into this. So having worked for small companies, large companies, I think I have a pretty good idea of what this market is about. And so, you know, in addition also to the various experiences in running organizations, I am also the chairman of Tech America Public Sector. And, you know, so that's an organization that reaches across the entire, all the technology companies.
So would you characterize yourself as a relationship guy or a task guy?
I think a lot of relationship. I think that.
So that's interesting to me because you're also a turnaround guy,
mm-hmm.
and turnaround guys fire people.
Well, you know, it's a balance. I think that you have to look at every situation as a balance, and on one hand you're building relationships that are associated with where you want the business to go. You're building relationships with the people that you work with, and ultimately, by the way, it is all about the people who work for you, who make the organization successful.
But, Tom, you didn't start out in the business area. You started out in the park service. Is that right? Tell us about that and how you transitioned.
Yeah, I sure did. I had the opportunity to join the National Park Service when I was younger, and I loved the idea of the parks, and my father had been associated with the National Park Service as well. and two different locations in the Washington area, most recently at Great Falls Park on the Virginia side. Spent about 3 years there, and very different. It's a day that starts typically when the sun is first coming up. You're outside all the time, and it's just a very completely different environment than this. But I am driven by challenge, and I recognize that the kind of challenge that I was looking for was probably not going to come from the parks, for as much as I loved it. And I decided to start attending some classes at Northern Virginia Community College in business and also in data processing, as it was called then, and had an opportunity to join the Boeing Company in 1981, and the most entry-level job they offered. So, you know, I made a choice at that point to make a major shift, and I haven't looked back since. It's been a heck of a lot of fun.
Where did this thing around challenge come from? How early in your life can you point back to this love of challenge?
That's a hard question to answer. I've given that some thought a few times, and because I do recognize about myself that I like the challenge. You know, I think once I got into the industry that I'm a part of now and began to understand the complexities of it and its associated challenges, I think I was very drawn to being deeply involved and having a lot of fun with it, I've had the opportunity to really take on some very interesting challenges.
Yeah. So let's ask it this way: big challenges give me the opportunity to do what?
To make a difference. Bottom line: to make a difference. You know, if you can create an environment for people that is good for them, if you can create an environment where you're able to advance a corporation's capabilities in certain areas in a way that's really meaningful, and you can look back at it and say, you know, that was a good thing. I'm drawn to that.
And why is that important to you? What makes that matter so much to you?
I think what it comes down to is really how you feel at the end of the day. Hmm. And if you can look back at the end of the day and say, I did make a difference, and I worked with a lot of great people to make a difference. You know, that's really what drives me.
Where are you from, Tom?
I'm a native Washingtonian, proud to say that. Born in the district. My parents actually met when they were both en route to the United States, and here I was 3 years later. Had three sisters, and enjoyed growing up in the Washington area. I did have a chance to live abroad when I was 9, 10, 11 years old in Stockholm, Sweden.
Mm-hmm. Your parents are from Sweden?
That's correct.
Uh-huh. What was that experience like for you?
It was very different. It was a time when I had the opportunity, number one, to learn the language and to live in a very different environment. It was also at a time during the Vietnam War. And, I think that many of the European countries were not as friendly toward Americans as they are today. And so it was very different in that regard. But also looking back, it was a great experience because I got exposed to a lot of things that I otherwise wouldn't have.
Yeah. How about some important mentors growing up? Anything you can think of?
You know, it's taken the form of some friends of the family. Generally, you know, I look at people who have been influential and successful. There are several people along my career path that have struck me as being really, really good at what they do, and in many ways I've tried to emulate that.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
how about leadership? Where did you learn how to lead? You lead pretty big companies. Where did that come from?
I think two things. It has evolved. And I think what you do is you pick up styles, you begin to learn the differences between various leadership styles, and you're attracted to various elements, and you put those together, that ultimately defines who you are.
So if it's evolved for you, how would you characterize your early days of leading versus how you lead today? What's different?
Well, I think that what happens is that you, I don't want to say that you necessarily become better at it. I think that your style evolves. And so that's the way that I would answer that question. So,
what do you like most about the job?
Well, it goes back to the challenge, honestly. You know, it goes back to defining something that you want to accomplish and being able to recognize the success that's associated with that.
Mm-hmm.
That is the great feeling that comes along with that.
So if you've taken on some big challenges, you must have failed once or twice along the way.
Absolutely. I do believe that You know, where you learn the most is when you stub your toe. And
so tell us about the time you stubbed your toe and what you pick up.
Well, I think that, you know, there have been a number of opportunities like that. I was asked to join the Raytheon company and to help to build a consolidated IT organization. You know, there were some things along the way there that were new. It was working inside of a very large corporate environment. And, you know, you make some decisions and you work to execute those. And sometimes perhaps they don't work. And those are the kinds of things you learn from.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Wiley is a privately held company, as I understand.
We are.
It.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the difference? I mean, you've worked for Boeing, Raytheon, CSC, Federal Data.
Yeah.
I mean, you've worked for some of the others. What is the difference between a privately held versus the more publicly held?
Well, you know, especially today, large or public corporations are in Wall Street's eye. And you have those pressures that are associated with your performance and your growth. A privately held organization like Wiley, and many of the others, let's say, that are held by private equity today, as we are, they very much also care about the performance of the organization. But those interests come in different flavors, and it's a different environment. You don't have, you know, the external public view of every move you're making, but you have interests that come from, you know, from your stockholders.
And so because you don't have that level of scrutiny, does that offer you more freedom and flexibility of choice?
Perhaps. You know, I think that it's fair to recognize that you always have some body of management.
Yeah, at the end of the day, you still have to make a profit.
Absolutely. You absolutely do. So it just feels a little different than, you know, privately held organizations just has a slightly different look and feel than the large corporations.
But do you not also have a little bit longer range view and longer range planning? It's not this quarter's profit only.
That is correct. And I do also recognize that, you know, every management entity is going to be different. But you know, certainly for us, right. You know, we have a strategic plan. We manage to that strategic plan. But it isn't the Wall Street.
What's your proudest moment up till now?
I don't know that I have a proudest moment. I felt very good about a variety of experiences over time, and you know, times when I've been able to go into an organization and make a difference. You know, I think it comes down to relationships that you build.
How about the toughest thing you've ever accomplished?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that you know, there's probably a couple things like that. You know, some of those examples might fit on the personal side, as right. You know, and some on the professional side. But you know, going into an organization and taking on a set of challenges and turning it around on the professional side
is very satisfying.
It is really very satisfying.
Great. Mm-hmm. What's the website address, Tom?
www.wiley.com, W-Y-L-E.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Tom Anderson, who's the president of the Science, Technology, and Engineering Group of Wiley. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Taylor, with the law firm of Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney for helping me out today. We've had a great lineup of guests, including Sid Fuchs, who's the president and CEO of Macaulay Brown and the author of Get Off the Bench, Chris Lessard, the president of Lessard Design, Alan Cullen, the president of Todd Allen, and finally, once again, Tom Anderson, the president of the Science, Technology, and Engineering Group of Wiley. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for without you, we wouldn't have a radio show. This is Peter Schwartz, your host. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on 1500 AM. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on 1500 AM. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no